If everyone could please take their seats so we can get started. Everyone could please take their seats. Okay, we're going to start in 1 minute, so if you could please take your seats. Okay, everyone please take their seats and we're going to get started. Okay, so first of all, welcome. My name is Bob Horenstein. I am the Chief Community Relations and Public Affairs Officer for the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. And I want to thank all of you for being here tonight. It's going to be a very important program and hopefully you'll leave tonight having learned something, being well informed. And so what I want to do is first thank our hosts, Congregation Neve Shalom. They've been a gracious host to many of our programs, which really reminds me that almost a year to the date that we did a similar program last September, Confronting Anti-Semitism in K-12 Schools. Some of you may have been here. And then a week and a half later, it was October 7th. And the challenges that we were already facing grew exponentially with rising anti-Semitism and anti-Israel sentiment that often crossed over into anti-Semitism in our K-12 schools. So tonight, this program is significant, and we want you to know that as parents or teachers, that you are our eyes and ears as to what is going on in our various districts. So I want to explain to you exactly what's going to happen tonight. First of all, I just want to point out this slide here with our community norms. This is going to be, of course, a respectful conversation tonight. So this is how it's going to work. The first half, roughly 45 minutes or so, we have our panel. I'll be introducing our panelists in a moment. And we're going to pose to them the sort of questions that you all have been asking. And I will tell you that some of them you'll get a clear answer tonight, and some of them you will not get a clear answer tonight because they are these gray areas that we're all sort of grappling with. So after that, we'll have a brief Q&A. Okay, the second part, which will be roughly half an hour, will be two of our parent co-leaders, Nir Magnazzi, who is the co-leader of the Beaverton school group over here, and then Mel Berwin, who is the co-leader of the Portland school parent group. And they will be discussing and providing suggestions, tips for how you can be an effective advocate for your students. especially in a proactive way. So they're going to be giving you tips. And so some of those are in your handouts. You had two different handouts there, so please take one. The last part, which will be maybe 10 minutes or so, will be a role play where we're going to showcase how the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland can be a supportive ally to you all, as parents, as families that are going through some sort of incident or issue, and how we can be a resource to the school as it works through that issue. That will be led by myself and Rachel Nelson. I want Rachel to stand up, because when we get those phone calls from you, it's more often than not that Rachel is the one who's answering it. And Rachel herself is a public school parent, and I will guarantee you that you will find her to be supportive, reassuring, and empathetic. And so we will get those calls, we'll work together as a team to address whatever the issue is, and then figure out how to resolve it with you, with your input, of course. So with that, we're going to start with our panel, and I'm going to be doing very quick introductions. So first, on the far side here is Karen Twain, who is a retired assistant superintendent with Tiger Tualatin School District. We have Taylor Lewis, who is the, I hope I'm saying the right title, the Civil Rights Title VI Specialist for the Oregon Department of Education, and Julia Brim Edwards, who is a member of the Portland School Board, and in her off time, she is a member of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. So what you see here is you have someone who represents did represent a school district, someone who represents a school board, and someone who represents the Oregon Department of Education. So we have several questions that we're going to ask, and Rachel will keep me on time. So we're going to start. So first of all, thank you all for taking the time to be with us tonight. So I want to start with the question that's always on everyone's mind, and this is probably more geared to you, Taylor. And I know, you know, you've done some webinars with us, and you probably got this question more than once. But what are the limits to freedom of speech, academic freedom, when we're talking about K through 12, say, as opposed to the college campus? And I want to sort of throw out a second question, which is very much related, and that is, I think, one of the most important questions that we can ask, which is a teacher free to express their personal political views in the classroom by either what they say, what they teach, what they wear, or what they put up in their classroom? And we're going to talk about a Portland policy that has something to do with that. We'll talk to Julie about that.
Okay. Hi, everyone. So as Bob mentioned early on here, that you're going to get some good answers and some challenging answers, and this is a challenging answer. This is an it depends answer. So students in K-12 settings do have rights to free speech on campus. K-12 is much more limited than what we see in higher education, but those free speech rights do still exist. Oregon in particular has really, really broad free speech protections under Article 1, Section 8 of our Oregon Constitution, as well as our implementing OARs and ORSs, which is our administrative rules and our statutes. So we have really broad free speech protections. Generally speaking, students on campuses are entitled to be able to express themselves through freedom of association, meaning they can set up clubs and affinity groups and express their political viewpoints on campus. They can demonstrate, they can put signs up, they can wear armbands or other political t-shirts, to a degree. There are still limitations here. And so some of those limitations would be anything that crosses the line into discriminatory harassment. If it's creating a hostile learning environment for students, that's something that the schools could regulate. If it is vulgar or indecent, we have some Supreme Court law that talks about that too, about how schools have the ability to limit things that they consider to be vulgar or indecent or otherwise substantially disrupting the educational environment. They also have some limitations, of course, into things that fall into defamation or other violations of state or federal law. In Oregon, one of our biggest ones would be something that we consider to be a true threat, meaning that this is something that would be substantially likely to happen and to incite violence. So those are some of our really broad protections. As I said, this is something that really comes down to kind of a case-by-case analysis. One of the big factors that schools want to look at when they're considering restricting student free speech would be whether this is reasonably likely to cause a substantial disruption to the learning environment. And we talk reasonably likely, we're talking about we have something based in fact, based in past patterns, and something that we have seen before, all of which would indicate that this is likely to happen. What we really can't be restricting are opinions or ideas that are unpopular, or opinions or ideas that are just expressing one side of an issue. So if schools are censoring one side of an issue, they need to make sure that they are doing it equally on both sides, that they're viewpoint neutral. In terms of educators, this is also a really hard one, and one that's governed by a lot of competing agreements. So of course we again have our First Amendment considerations, our Oregon Constitution considerations, our OARs and our ORSs, but in terms of teachers, we also have things like collective bargaining agreements. And those collective bargaining agreements put a lot of parameters around what our educators can or can't say, so it's gonna look a little bit different per district. We have our state and federal laws that give us some general parameters, but then we also have for each district some collective bargaining agreements that are going to dictate that for your specific school district. In terms of what our general requirements look like when we're looking at political speech, teachers are, for the most part, able to say what they want outside of their classroom environment, with, again, some limitations. If it's causing a substantial disruption to the learning environment, that's something that potentially the schools have the ability to restrict. In school, it looks a little different. When they're actually in classrooms during the school day, they're considered public employees. And public employees do have fewer rights to be able to express themselves the way that they see fit during the classroom time. So those protections are going to look a lot stronger during the class sessions, during times in which they are acting under the scope and direction of the school district.
So we'll get to the questions. Yeah, just hold your question. I'm gonna come back to you for a couple follow-ups, but Julia, Portland Public Schools, the school board, I understand, adopted a policy that relates to visual representations in the classroom. Do you want to explain what that is? And it's being challenged. It's being challenged by the union and perhaps by the ACLU. But what does it say at this point related to this question?
I'm going to have two disclaimers before I start. One, I'm not a lawyer, so good thing we have one here. And second, I'm just here speaking as a parent and as an individual school board member, not necessarily representing PPS. So recently, the district, the school, how things get divided between staff and the school board is the school board sets high-level policy, which is really setting the direction, and then staff, they are responsible for implementing our policies, and they usually do that through what are called administrative directives. So what Bob was just referencing is we already have an existing policy that relates to what can be displayed and distributed already, where the initially it came about in the early 2000s that was directed at the Boy Scouts and the military, who had discriminatory policies. And so recently what the district staff did is they took that policy, which is setting the general direction, and underneath it they issued a new administrative directive that deals with what can be posted on classroom walls and then also in common areas of schools. And the important thing to remember, the important thing about this administrative directive is it's content neutral. So school districts can't just decide, oh, all of a sudden we don't like what is being posted, so we're gonna have a set of rules around what's being posted. So what the district did is it created an administrative directive, and it's available, I think.
Yeah, it's in the packet.
The handout. Mm-hmm. But it essentially said, if you're gonna display something in the classroom, your classroom displays are really supposed to be connected, need to be connected to the curriculum and the learning that's happening in the classroom at the time. And that anything that gets displayed, like student work, needs to connect to that. So that's in the classroom. And then they also have some new requirements about what can be posted, and any of you are in PPS, you'll know that there was a lot of things that were posted. It was a little bit like the Wild West in the hallways and the cafeterias. And this new administrative directive, again, has it's content neutral, but the content of what is being displayed has to be connected to what learning and the curriculum and what's happening in the classroom, and has to be approved by the administrator. So hopefully this will provide guidelines so that individual parents don't have to be sort of the police or the sheriff about, I saw something, you know, in the hallway that is completely disconnected from the curriculum, and that it really puts some of the responsibility, provides clear guidelines and puts the responsibilities back on the leadership of the school.
You can keep that. Karen, was there anything like that in Tigard-Walton when you were there?
I mean, things really came to light a couple elections ago when Black Lives Matter really resurged, and there was a lot of things going on. And so we had, you know, posters of Colin Kaepernick kneeling and, you know, different things. And so there was a lot of concerned parents, people who, you know, raised issues. And we always go to our attorneys and ask, you know, what's acceptable, what isn't. And so this directive that Portland has put out, I think, is really important because, you know, if a kid's walking into a math class, a health class, what is associated with the curriculum? And this will give some guidance in Portland Public and in other school districts if they choose to adopt something similar. In Tigard-Walton right now, there's a variety of policies, not as specific quite yet as Portland Public. But I know a lot of the districts in Oregon are looking at all of this. And it's, again, important, especially in this election year, where there's a lot of things being said and opinions being given, both by students and educators. So, I think it's in motion.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, we will get questions, so just keep the questions. I just do want to mention one concrete example in a Portland high school where a teacher, I don't know what the teacher was teaching, but had on his door posters accusing Israel of genocide, and the principal made that teacher take them down. So that's an example. That's the kind of thing we ran into over and over again last year. So just one quick follow-up. Taylor, you mentioned a hostile climate. Can you define what that means?
Yes, I can. And I'm also going to give my disclaimer that I do have my JD, but I am not giving anyone legal advice tonight. I'm not your attorney. Please don't take it as legal advice. But a hostile learning environment actually does have a federal definition. So this comes from Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VI is our Civil Rights Act that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin in any program that gets federal funding. So that would include, you know, all public school districts, charter schools, magnets, and all their associated activities. Title VI also considers shared ancestry characteristics, which is generally where we see our Jewish students fall. It does not prohibit discrimination on the basis of religion. We do have laws that do that. It's just not Title VI. So when we're looking at Title VI, we're looking at those shared ancestry characteristics, so things that would be commonly associated with kids that are Jewish, Sikh, Muslim, Christian, anything kind of in that vein, as opposed to religious practices. So Title VI does have some specific definitions for what they're considering to be a hostile learning environment, and that would be harassment that is so severe, persistent, or pervasive that it's restricting a student from enjoying the benefits or privileges of their educational programming. I really want to note the or there, because that's super important. So it's severe, persistent, or pervasive, meaning that it could be any one of those things or any combination of them. Sometimes what we hear are folks concerned that something only happened one time. And while typically, if we're looking at whether a hostile environment existed, we're looking at something that happened a lot of times, it doesn't have to. We can have something be so severe that one time is enough to create a hostile environment for students. And when a district is considering whether a hostile environment exists, one of the things that we really want to look at is how the student is being able to participate in and benefit from their programming. So something that we see a lot when a hostile environment exists would be something like a student with withdrawing from their program, meaning that they don't want to go to school anymore. They don't want to play basketball. They're worried about speaking up in class. They don't feel like they can express themselves. They're worried about retaliation. Anything that kind of falls in that vein might be an example of when a hostile environment exists.
So we have a few questions specifically about curriculum. Okay, so I'm going to start sort of generally. What role does a superintendent's office and school board play in evaluating and improving curriculum? So I'm going to either Karen and or Julia.
We probably can tag team because I'll give you, I'll do it from the school board perspective. So all of our curriculum is approved by the school board. But by the time it gets to the school board, it's been very extensively vetted. So as you all might know, if you serve on the school board, you're a volunteer. Most of the time, the people serving on the school board are not educators. During my 11 years on the school board, I've had an opportunity. I served with a woman who was a professor at PSU who had lots of expertise. And currently on our school board, we have two former teachers. So we have some expertise on the board, but generally we're lay people. And we're all parents who care passionately about our kids in public education. So eventually, because we approve anything at Portland Public Schools, anything that's over 150,000, expenditures over 150,000, we approve curriculum. So over the last 6 years, I think we've approved over $70 million worth of curriculum. So quite a lot, both the materials, but also the professional development that goes with it. But before it gets to us, it's gone through a very extensive vetting process that the superintendent and the district office leads. And often on the curriculum committee, say it's for high school science, you will have on the committee some high school science teachers who will provide sort of their classroom expertise to the larger curriculum committee. But it is usually done by a large committee. It's based on state standards, and especially now in Portland, we're adopting a lot of new curriculum, but I would say we have, by the time it gets to the board, it is been substantially vetted, and usually it's curriculum that aligns with just best practices. So that's from the board standpoint. So you could talk about how, before
sure.
it gets to the board.
As Julia said, I mean, these are vetted processes. They take a lot of time and effort and brain power. And each district is slightly, they could be slightly different in their process about how they go about things. But most districts in general will pull together a committee as they're adopting curriculum. And most curriculum are on cycles, so, you know, you don't do it every year. Oftentimes it's anywhere between 4 and 7 years. And so particularly with areas like health, for example, where there's a lot of disagreement about how, you know, sexual practices should be taught and gender issues and those kinds of things. For the most part, we try to include different perspectives, different points of view. And Julia mentioned this, but this is what I would underscore, is when I've led these processes, we really focus on the standards. So it's not people sitting down with a bunch of opinions and agendas, but it's here's the standards for health, science, math, literacy, social studies. And from those standards, you choose from different curriculum. And oftentimes, they will be tried out. They'll be tested in different places. And the unions involved, oftentimes community members are involved, some parents who may care about these issues. And then a recommendation from that committee often will go to possibly the cabinet, which is, you know, the directors in that school district, but ultimately the superintendent and the school board. It'll get to them. And with ODE, they also have suggested or acceptable curriculum so that, you know, you're not just pulling from all sorts of odd places, but really you work together. Both ODE, school district level, community level, and then make that recommendation that the school board ultimately will approve with the superintendent.
So should these parents have the expectation that when it comes to a controversial topic, however we may define that, that based on the state academic content standards, that a subject will be taught from multiple viewpoints free of overt bias?
It's supposed to be.
We have with us Amit Kabrowski, who's also with ODE. Maybe, Amit, do you want to say anything about that?
So I was just saying that the curriculum is sort of the in-class lesson plans, the daily activities, the questions that are asked by the teacher, the discussions that are set up. That's sort of what we refer to as curriculum. So the department itself does the standards. We do a process where we help identify instructional materials that are aligned to those standards. School boards may decide to purchase those materials or find their own materials and run a process very similar to ours to identify the materials. But in most school districts in Oregon, especially in the metro area, there's a lot of autonomy for teachers to sort of design lessons based on the instructional materials and on those standards. And so that's where you might see some variety in how teachers are handling certain topics. And so that's where, on the last question you asked about controversial speakers, most districts do have a controversial speaker policy about sort of a fair and balanced approach. But you know, which reading materials are selected, which supplements to go with the instructional materials. There's a lot of choices that are being made by teachers or by building principals.
Can I just add
something? Yeah,
go ahead. So I first got on the school board in 2000. I was on from 2001 to 2005, then off for 10 years, and then came back in 2017. But in 2000, it was right after ballot measure 5 had passed, and literally one of the ways that PPS responded to it, to the basically pretty dramatic decline in resources, was they cut the curriculum department. And for 25 years, the district has been out of compliance for like adopted curriculum materials. So we get from ODE, here's the cycle you should adopt it on, here are the learning standards. But PPS didn't have the resources, and I will say that because of the 2020 bond, where we made a very significant investment so that all of we now have curriculum that's district adopted and given to teachers, and they get professional development on them. It's the first time, like I say, since I think Measure 5 that we are actually in compliance with the curriculum standards. So what you had, like when my kids were in elementary school, literally, depending on what school you went into, that there was a different way they taught math or a different curriculum. So there was, for a while, they were getting great results at Woodmere Elementary in math. And there was this thing called Woodmere Math. And schools would say, like, we're teaching Woodmere Math. And it was just the curriculum the teachers had developed. And so you had a very patchwork system without a lot of standards. And we still have a fair number of teachers in PPS who, that was when they entered their teaching careers. So it's a very different environment. And so you have, a lot of times, people were just on their own. Like, you got to come up with your lessons plans and the standards, and your textbooks are going to be 30 years old. And that's changing now. But there's still a lot of individuals who are teaching that started their careers when that was not the case. And I think you see that still across PPS. And I think probably less the case in Beaverton than some other districts, but certainly in Portland it was pretty epidemic.
Just to add one thing, and that is when we're talking curriculum, you know, we think sort of textbooks. That's probably the easiest way to think about it. But understand that teachers have a lot of leeway in terms of what books they use and those kinds of things. And again, we always say, well, does it tie to the standards? How are you using that? So there is a lot of variability and teacher discretion in terms of what they actually use in their classroom, even if there's an accepted curriculum and textbook adoption.
So let's talk about a specific example that seems to be mostly specific to Portland, but in fact, you'll find that it's not. So we had a situation, the teachers' union in Portland, which has been in the news, a lot of you have been following what's been going on. We have a teachers union that has been promoting pro-Palestinian, or if you prefer, anti-Israel political advocacy. And one of the things that they were doing was pushing out, or trying to push out, some materials and use this in quotes, curriculum that many of us in the Jewish community found to be one-sided and inflammatory and offensive. It's called Teach Palestine. And so there was a lot of pressure put on the union. They backed off. They removed these materials and this curriculum from their website, at least temporarily. However, what we've now learned is that there is a conference called the Northwest Teaching for Social Justice Conference, which is attended potentially by hundreds of teachers from districts all over Oregon and Washington. And there is this year, now this is a conference that is sponsored by a group called Rethinking Schools, which is the one that created the Teach Palestine curriculum. And it's also co-sponsored by the Portland Association of Teachers. And they are spotlighting this curriculum, which I think many of us would actually call propaganda. So we're going to see teachers going to the conference, possibly going to the session, which I think there is a keynote speaker. There was a teacher who was teaching this at one of our Portland high schools who is one of the keynote speakers. And we're all wondering, what can we do about it? Is there anything that can be done about it? Because clearly that curriculum does not comply with anyone's standards. Any thoughts about?
Well, I think the expectation has been stated that we expect our teachers to use the curriculum the district has approved that's aligned with the state standards. So we've set the expectations. Now, having been a parent for 18 years in PPS, I know that everybody doesn't always listen to the central office. And what I found is generally we rely, we can say this is what our expectation is and provide the materials. Our principals are, our building level leaders, so they're very important in this, the conversation, because they're the ones who, pop into classrooms and see what's posted in the hallways. So we can set expectations, and again, the principals are the ones who also are responsible within their schools to do that. We also rely on parents, because things happen that, for sure the school board may not hear about, because while we may be parents and active and talk to a lot of parents, we're also volunteers. And also the same thing with the district staff. They may not hear it, so we really do rely on parents, letting us know if they have a concern that, this doesn't seem aligned with the curriculum, or I have a concern about it. And as you mentioned, sort of being the eyes and ears, so sharing that with the principal or whoever you feel comfortable with, the board, district staff, that's the way it can be addressed. But I will say that I think PPS has been pretty clear about what our expectations are.
Anybody else?
I should add, too, that if there is a concern about, the content of a particular curriculum, that's kind of already been covered. Those are your options to go talk to the board if you dislike it or find it offensive, or think that it's one-sided. But if it has crossed a line into we now think that not only is this offensive or one-sided, but it's actually discriminatory. What we're teaching folks is stereotypical. It's relying on outdated understandings of Israeli or Jewish students, or something that's prohibiting your student from actually being able to learn in their classroom. At that point, you do also have complaint options through your district process, through ODE's appeal process, or potentially with the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. I do want to make it clear that that's not just if we don't like the content or don't agree with it. It does have to actually meet the definition of discriminatory, but if it has gotten to that point, those options and those avenues are available too.
That's a great point, because in Portland Public Schools, it's required by ODE that every district have a formal complaint process. And so, Portland, if you go on the pps.net/conflict-resolution, it lays out sort of the process by which you can file a complaint, and there's a form that you can fill out, and you can file an anonymous complaint. But those go through a very, if they meet certain standards, go through a very set process. The district has to provide a written response. There's various steps, and ultimately you can, depending on what the issue is, you can appeal to the board. And if you're, and again, depending on what the issue is, can appeal to ODE as well. And I mean, as a parent, I've used that before. Well, not when I was on the school board, but it was around instructional hours, and it went all the way to the state. And the state actually found for the parent group that the district was violating instructional hours, and they had to go into a corrective action plan. So there are mechanisms. Generally, what I would say is that it's better to try and resolve it. I think you get more satisfactory outcomes from going through the more an informal process, but there always is the formal process that parents, you know, if you need to use it, it's available, and it's required that every district have a formal complaint process.
And just to be clear, even though it may be about a particular teacher or school, the complaint is actually going to the district, and it's the responsibility of the district to resolve it.
Yes. Again, it depends on what it is. So only some can be appealed to the school board, and only some school board decisions can be appealed to ODE. It depends on the topic.
Susan, just because you're a school board member, I'll let you ask a question. Yes, yes. So we have just two or three more questions, and then we'll open it up. Taylor, you kind of alluded to this, but I'm going to, because it's an actual situation, it's in a school district in the metro area, let's put it that way, where we had a school teacher using their private media, social media, to post what many of us would consider to be vile anti-Semitic messages. Now, it's on their private time, but if a student, a Jewish student, Jewish parent, even a Jewish colleague, teacher, sees that, there's no recourse because it's all on the private, and it's freedom of speech, and that as long as it doesn't make its way into the classroom, there's nothing much we can do about that?
Well, that's a really hard question. That is an it depends question for sure. One of the tests that the Supreme Court looks at when they're looking at educator free speech is what they call a balancing test. This comes about from a Supreme Court decision called Pickering, which is like a 1967 case. It's old. We don't have a whole lot of Supreme Court cases about educator free speech, so it gets really gray. But one of the things that the courts look at is what they call a balancing test between the state's interest in restricting speech and the educator's private right to be able to speak freely. And they kind of do a balancing test to look at, like, well, where do the factors fall here? And one of the major factors is whether it's substantially disrupting the educational environment. And soon you say, Bob, if it makes its way into the school, it kind of depends on what you mean by that. Is that parent after parent calling and filing formal complaints? Is that other people not wanting to be in this teacher's class anymore? Is this disrupting the harmony between the teachers? Is it causing this person to be unable to do their job well because of the repercussions of the speech? Those types of things would be a substantial alteration to the environment that might allow a district to take some action because of those private speech moments. But that can get really tricky. And what makes this sort of conversation around free speech hard is that there's a distinction between what the school and school district are able to do and what they're required to do. They're not quite the same thing. So the schools have the ability sometimes to take action, but that doesn't inherently mean that they have to take action if a teacher is saying something in their private time. So it's a floor versus the ceiling, basically, which gets really messy. Again, though, same thing, that if this is trickling its way into the school environment and a student feels like they are being treated differently or experiencing that hostile environment, those same protections apply regardless of who is the instigator of that harm. So whether it's a student or a staff member, those protections still apply in school.
Again, to add one small thing to that, I think what's gotten really tricky for probably everybody in this audience, in educators in particular, is the whole concept of social media. You can never get ahead of it anymore. And so it's so reactive, and sometimes damage is done, and there you are. And so, I just make the point, I don't have the solution, but just to know that maybe many of us aren't on social media, but the kids are. All of them are. And so they're seeing things possibly by their teachers or their peers that don't feel good. It's done in private time, and we just need to circle around our kids and let them know the boundaries and what that means and, you know, talk to them about how that feels and all those kinds of things. I mean, basically, we need to love our kids up. And paramount to everything is that our kids, Jewish and otherwise, need to feel safe when they're in school. And that's what when I talk to families, I say, how does your child feel? Do they feel safe? If a kid ever comes to me and says, I don't feel safe, that's a huge flag. Okay, let's unpack that a little bit and let's get to why you don't feel safe. And then you can think about what the next steps are, if there are next steps. So that's my...
One of the complex issues among the ones we've been talking about. So you get, let's say, a parent files a complaint alleging anti-Semitism. Well, you know, depends what the circumstances are. Maybe for some of us, a teacher putting up posters accusing Israel of genocide over the classroom would be considered anti-Semitic, even though it may not be and the intention may not be. So I know that the U.S. Department of Education, in looking at Title VI complaints, uses the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. It's in your packet, but I think we also have a slide to that effect. But, I mean, is there a what is the definition? Is there a uniform definition that is being used in assessing these circumstances where a parent is alleging anti-Semitism in a classroom or in a school?
Yeah, so I do want to note that this IRA definition up here is not codified, meaning it's not written into law. Where this comes from is a 2019 executive order in which the Trump administration required that the OCR, so the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, consider this working definition when they're looking at anti-Semitism. So they're not required to utilize that definition, but they have to see whether whether they're informed by that definition and the contemporary examples that it contains. So it's not written into law per se. In Oregon, we don't have a set definition of anti-Semitism in particular, but we do define discrimination in law under our statutes. Our Oregon Revised Statute 659850 has our definition of discrimination, and it's really broad. So in Oregon, we're looking at really any unfair differential treatment, whether it's intended or unintended, based on protected class status. So that's super important to know. In federal law, we sometimes hear this called as disparate impact. In Oregon, it's called fair and form, but discriminatory in operation. So we're really looking at situationally, was the student treated differently than another student, even if it wasn't intentional, even if that wasn't the goal, based on their protected class status? And that's how we're defining whether discrimination happened.
Okay. So one last question.
I'll just say, I didn't realize this until you sent the questions. In our policies and administrative directives, we do define it. So I'd be more than, I'd be interested in getting feedback on whether you think we've nailed it or not as part of the policy implementing Every Student Welcome, which is the state required every school district to create a policy and administrative directive. And it really is about creating safe learning environments for all students. But I'd love to get afterwards people's take on whether we've got it right or not.
Okay.
Can I add to that, actually? Just one sec, Bob. The law that was just mentioned is Every Student Belongs, which is really important to note that law is Oregon-specific that does say that there are certain symbols that are unequivocally not allowed. And those include a noose, a swastika, and a Confederate flag. So any use of those symbols, kind of regardless of what happened, what went into that, is just simply expressly outlined by law. So that's not like a fact-specific inquiry as to whether that's not allowed. It just isn't.
Yeah, I think the challenge is for some instances that are emotionally triggering that make a student feel unsafe may not be specifically anti-Semitic. So the last question is something that comes up a lot. What advice would you give to parents whose students have experienced what they believe is anti-Semitism, but they don't want the parents to get involved? It's like, don't make waves. I mean, what would you suggest to a parent where a student just doesn't want to, you know, get involved, doesn't want the parent to get involved even though it's a serious situation? Any thoughts about that?
I mean, I can give it a go, but here's the thing. With many times, you want to resolve issues on a very local, personal, immediate way, meaning the child should be able to go to the teacher and say, what you said made me feel uncomfortable, I don't feel safe, or whatever. But when you're that student, that might be really hard. There's a power dynamic there. Will the teacher downgrade me? Will the teacher not like me? Will the teacher, you know, all the things that you know. So they can give it a shot if they can. And if they can't, they need to find another teacher, another adult, another friend, somebody to help them. And they can ask their parents, but some kids, as Bob mentioned, don't feel comfortable doing that. However, if they make a couple attempts, as a parent, if they have told you, you've got to say, at this point, it sounds like you need some help. And let's do this together. I can sit and listen as you explain to the teacher or the principal or whomever what's going on. I mean, none of this is easy. And if you feel like you're on the fringe or something has happened to you, you know, you're shaky, you're nervous. It's, you know, it makes you anxious. And so oftentimes, especially our high schoolers who want to be adults, who want to be independent, they want to solve their own problems. But the truth is they're still kids and they can't. And so, you know, there's not a perfect answer to this other than to say, if they can, do, and if they can't, help step in, either as the parent or find an adult who can help them navigate the system or the people or whatever's happening. That's my best advice.
I think that's great advice. As a parent of three kids, my children were often like, why are you on the school board? Like, because we wanted, like, lay low and not have anybody know who we are. And so our kids do often not want us to get involved. But I think in addition, like most schools have counselors that can all be another trusted adult. If you know about it, say the second case that Karen talked about, if you know about it and your student doesn't want you to reach out to the principal or the teacher, I mean, this is when I have had issues. There's like some power in numbers. It's like other parents to have conversations that are more generic, that aren't specifically to your child's experience, but often your child's not the only person having that experience. So bringing other parents into the conversation is powerful. Sometimes you have to like just call an outside group to provide assistance. I know in the early 2000s, when we were wrestling with lots of issues with the Boy Scouts and again the military, lots of our students felt unsafe, and there were advocacy community groups who came in and advocated for them. So it wasn't the individual student or the parent advocating for their individual students, but more for all students who might be in that situation. So I think there's a variety of different ways in which, you know, if your child doesn't want you to get involved, that you can still provide the support they need. Because the thing I've found is, like, if it happened to one student, it most likely has happened to other students. And so even if you're just solving it for your student, there's other students who might not have their issues addressed. So.
Okay, so Rachel, you're going to take the mic around. So we only have a few minutes for Q&A. So what I'm going to ask is that if you have a question, I'm going to give you two or three sentences. If it doesn't end in a question mark, then I'm going to cut you off because we're going to have to move on. So please do not make statements. Ask your question.
Hi. Thank you, first of all, for being here. Really appreciate it. I was curious, what kind of publicly available information is out there around complaints that have been submitted to district or state or whatever entity? Just because if you don't know what's happening, it can feel like you're the only one.
That is a great question. So we have a log of previous orders that are available on ODU's website, so you could take a look at what has previously occurred and see what has been ordered as a corrective action. On a federal level, too, OCR publishes their case resolutions. They're publicly available. So if you search that, you looked up OCR case resolutions, you can take a look at what has previously been decided. They also currently are keeping a running list of all pending Title VI shared ancestry complaints. So this won't contain the information about, like, what specifically happened because it hasn't been founded yet, but it will tell you who's had a complaint filed against them based on what.
This is going to be really tough. I'm a little confused, no disrespect, also in some despair. I'm just a little confused. My name is Mark, because I came here a lot to learn about actual, like, personal anti-Semitic attacks on students, whether it's saying, hey, Jew in the classroom, or worse stuff. And I really want to hear that. And maybe if we have groups later, I can hear something, you know. On the other hand, I'm interested in the politics of what's considered truly anti-Semitic versus what's considered valid criticism of Israel. My despair is that in between stuff like the PPS's program this year, which, Bob, we've talked before, we'll talk later, okay. I agree that that was propaganda. That was pure advocacy. But on the other hand, what I'm afraid of is that the really hard stuff, how can the hard stuff get into the curriculum, for example, related to the Israeli occupation, related to the obliteration of Gaza and the pogroms in the West Bank?
Okay. Yeah, we're not going to go down that road. We can have that conversation, but that's not the topic for today.
I guess my question has to relate to, you have some private school parents in the audience, so wondering how, maybe for the Department of Education, how any of this, what we're talking about, applies to private school students.
Our state complaint process wouldn't apply to private school students unless they get state funds, which generally private schools don't. The Title VI protections may or may not, depending on whether they get federal funding. So if they get any amount of federal funding, those Title VI protections still exist.
Isn't there like a private school ombudsman and like a committee, or isn't there representation for private schools in the Department of Education?
We have a private school state ombudsman. So there is somebody that is kind of like the communication point between private schools, but our state non-discrimination statute applies specifically to public schools.
We have time for one more question.
My question has to do with when there's a difference between policy and practice. And what I think I hear you saying is that we are the eyes and ears and then should continue on. But my question is, what happens when you do that at a school level and you find that school leadership is neither demonstrating that they have the capacity nor inclination to follow up? And if there's a pattern of that, what happens then? And how does that work in a sense of urgency for children, right? So, like, because I feel like part of what I hear you saying is, like, there are administrative directives, and they go down to schools. What specifically, maybe for PPS, is the school board doing to build up that capacity of school leaders and ensure that is actually what's happening in schools? What's being proactively done so that the onus isn't just on us to report back and move through protocols that take a while?
I just want to say, if that happens, please make sure you call Rachel and Bob. So that's one thing, but yes, go ahead.
So I want to just get back to, so we do try, and because as you can imagine, with 45,000 students, there's a whole host of different issues that come up every day, and we do try and provide support for teachers in the building, both leaders and classroom teachers and support staff, to here's how we can, and we've really, post-pandemic, added a lot more resources to help schools resolve issues at the school level. And we've done that through training and providing supports and more resources. If you can't resolve something with a teacher, if this, again, it kind of depends on if the problem is with the teacher or with another student or with another staff member, but just generally the protocol is like the teacher and then the principal. And all the principals, if they're not doing their job or not following district policies, there are senior directors, and if you go on the district website, it tells you who those people, individuals are, and they're the supervisors, and they provide the coaching to the principals. I mean, certainly, the principal supervisors are often in their schools and providing, especially for new principals, providing coaching and support both on curriculum, but also on how to support their students and to make sure that we're following, that their teachers are following district directives and approved practices. I would say yes, and I really sympathize with you, because having been a parent, I've been a parent outside, and we had this huge issue where they cut the instructional hours for all high school students in Portland, and we did have to go to ODE, but we first went to the principals and the principal supervisor, the superintendent, the school board. They wouldn't resolve it. I mean, so it's that is very, from my perspective, very undesirable for parents to have to do that. So you shouldn't have to, but if you're not getting a response from the senior director, I'd write to the school board and also to the superintendent.
And if the school board does not write
back? Well, they're also, it depends on what the issue is. So I will say, just as somebody who is a volunteer with a full-time job, some weeks I might get 500 emails. I try and write back if I can. But if the other thing is, you can get it into the formal complaint process, which if it's an issue that you can file a complaint for, and there's a requirement then. I mean, the state requires that the district has X number of days to file a response, and then you can appeal that to another level. Again, I think hopefully parents don't, I don't think parents should have to do that. Again, I'm happy afterwards to talk to you about what the specific issue is, but you should get a response from the district.
What's a reasonable time frame for a response from the supervisor? What would you say? I mean, obviously, some matters are more urgent than others.
I mean, if it's urgent, I would say the next day, and I do see that happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, every morning my inbox is full. There's a lot of stuff that happens in our school, and a lot of pretty traumatic stuff, things that happen, and it's student to student, and it's sometimes staff and sometimes community members coming in. But I see when something urgent comes in, it's dealt with right away. And there's a lot of volume, and some people are better than others.
Can I add another point? Yeah, another point of contact to consider, too. Oregon passed a new law in January of 2024, so it's brand new. That requires that every public school district and every charter school in Oregon have a civil rights coordinator. So that person is supposed to help be your point person if you do have a discrimination-related concern. They should be somebody that can help funnel you to the right person to make sure that the processes are being followed correctly. So they might be a point of contact as well. If you haven't heard back from your principal, you could always reach out to your civil rights coordinator too. Those names should be published on the website as well. If you're in Portland, they are.
Okay, we need to move on. So I want to thank our panelists for their answers. And so we have about 20 minutes, 25 minutes for the next section. So Nir and Mel, I'm going to call on you to come on up and take it away.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mel Berwin. I'm Director of Congregational Learning here at Neve Shalom. I'm a Portland Public School parent, and I'm the co-chair of the Portland public schools, parent advocacy group with Scotty Weintraub.
Hi, I'm Nir Mignazi. I have a kid in Sunset and a kid in Stoller, and I'm part of the parents group for Beaverton School District, if that's the right definition. And what we want to try to do today is empower you. Why do we actually need empowerment? Because when we hear all those incidents, getting some noise, some feedback. Okay. Great. So maybe let's start with a lift of hands. Whose kids have faced any anti-Semitic response, slur, incident in school? Raise your hand. Just look around. Okay, this is where we are right now. So what we want to do today is to empower you and help you understand what to do before, during, and after such an incident happens. The first thing that happens is, when it happens, is we get angry and afraid and we feel helpless. And I think that's the worst feeling ever, to feel helpless. And you want to shout, you want to scream, because someone is hurting your kid, they're hurting their soul. And we as parents, we want to protect our kids. But guess what? We can't be there for them. Or we can be there with them. We can prepare them. We can prepare ourselves. And then as a community, we have some steps that we can take together. So we'll start with Mel. And she's going to cover the pre-steps. And then we'll cover the during and after.
Thank you. So we put together some resources for you this evening. We really wanted to get as kind of practical as possible in terms of what are the steps that we can take as parents, how we talk to our kids, and then what happens if something comes up. And our step number one is educate ourselves. You're all here, right? We're here to listen. We're here to learn. Thank you to Karen and Julia and Taylor for that helpful conversation around some of those pieces. There were a lot of different things that they mentioned that are in this packet here in more detail. There's actually two packets that you should have picked up at the front desk, and they're out there if you want to, if you didn't get one. And one is, right, the first thing is just educating ourselves. What's anti-Semitism? How do we recognize it, right? We get that kind of kishka, as Nir said, right? You know, we get it in our kishkas when our kids come home and say, oh, this happened, right? Or if we hear about it from another family. And it can be complicated to figure out, right? Does this rise to the level of anti-Semitism? I mean, all of those hands that you just had up, right? Each of you recognize that something is wrong, right? And unfortunately, this is the world that we're living in at the moment, right? So on the backside of this, of the parent advocacy procedures is, it's not just the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. I actually think that these 11 points are in some ways more helpful than the definition itself, that gives examples of anti-Semitism that can kind of help back up or help us clarify our thinking about what anti-Semitism can look like, right? And another piece is reading up on all of these different kind of pieces that we've just been hearing about the federal, the state, and our district-based or school-based, in some cases, policies. And just really understanding what are these processes, what are the policies, right? What should be being followed here, including information about Title VI, about that every student belongs, that definition of harassment, about the complaint processes. We've got links in here for all of those different pieces, as well as some clips of information as well. And they're actually pretty easy to find on websites if you know what you're looking for and are using the right information. So it is on us to do some of that research and really do some of that reading to really kind of understand what's meant to be followed here, and what is what are the policies that can be supportive to us if and when we should need them. Another piece, right? is to really have that same conversation with our kids and really to make sure that they understand what these definitions are, what their rights are, what should be happening in our schools, and to find out, I mean, all of those hands raised again means you're talking to your kids, which is a good thing, right? Sometimes we have to just kind of be a little bit more explicit in those conversations and ask them, you know, what's uncomfortable, what's happening, what are you learning in your history class, can I take a look at the syllabus, right? Some of those different pieces, what they're hearing just in kind of the conversations. Is it coming from the kids? Is it coming from the teachers? What are they seeing on social media, right? All of those different pieces, because there's a lot of different things that are coming at our kids, and they shouldn't feel alone either, and that's really important. And then the next piece has to do with building relationships, and that's also something that, you know, is one of the main purposes of us being here together and these gatherings that that Bob and Rachel have been bringing us together for, is really kind of helping us to empower ourselves as a community to get to know each other and get to know the leadership in our schools, right? Do you know your principal? Have you had a conversation with them before there's a challenge, right? So that they kind of know you as a parent. Do you know your school board member or members? Do you know the other Jewish parents in your children's schools? We've created a WhatsApp group for all of the parents, right, in this metro area? Just PPS. PPS. We've created one for PPS. Well, we've got another one that's for... No?
Not yet.
Okay. What do I know?
If families are interested, we can...
Start. Okay, we can create new ones for other districts. And then from the PPS one, we also wanted to be able to create school-based groups as well. So all of the Wells High School, parents or Franklin High School parents or whatever, right, can be have smaller WhatsApp groups within that as well. And it's a big reason why we want to have these parent advocacy groups that are district by district so that we can create those as well. So I know that there are a number of the leaders of those district-based groups in this room, and I don't know if we're going to have time to kind of just mention some of those other members, but we want to make sure that you are connected to the representative for your school district so that you have that. And you can reach out to Rachel if you want to get connected. So those are kind of some of the bigger pieces in terms of educating ourselves, having conversations with our kids, being in communication with them, and then building those relationships again, hopefully before we really need to call on them.
There's a lot of power in community. If you need to go to the principal on your own, you're one versus one. It's one person. The principal can say, yes, okay, fine. But if you come as a group of parents in the same school with concerns, you have more power. That's why having a WhatsApp group or whatever kind of communication you decide on within the group that brings together all the parents, the Jewish parents in the school, and you come together, as many as possible, with the concern, guess what? Principals want peace. They don't want all this nonsense in their school. They want to teach. They want to take care of education. They don't want anti-Semitism in their school. And if you come together and say, this is disturbing, our kids are not safe, you need to do something about it, there's a high chance they will listen. And if they will not, well, we have Bob, we have Rachel, and we will escalate. We also have to show that we're not trying to appease everyone. We will not let it go. We're done with letting it go. We have to stand up for ourselves. We have to be at the forefront of the fight of anti-Semitism. And if we raise our voices, again, it will disturb the peace. It's more likely for them to take action. Now, it doesn't have to start with the principal. My kid... was in a class where the teachers showed someone from CNN, and of course, guess what wasn't CNN? One-sided report from, hey, how Israel is bombing Gaza. No context. We're talking about eighth grader. No context at all. Just 10 top reels from CNN, and let's talk about them. And of course, my kid is very aware, called me immediately, recorded that, said, Dad, very one-sided. I said, okay. Me and my wife went and met with the teacher. The teacher waved a lot of hands. No, I didn't see the video before. I didn't choose, blah, 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 blah. And of course, the day after, we found out that this was the third time he's shown that video to kids. So we had to escalate. And a group of us went to the principal, and we demanded that some action will be taken. And this teacher, I can tell you, this year does not teach at that school. Now, was it because of us? I don't know, but I know that he never again shown any video that is related to the conflict or even shown one side. We have to take action. We need to be what we call politely aggressive. Just stand for what we believe in. Okay? Be firm. Don't let it go. Don't brush it because it's uncomfortable. It is highly uncomfortable. We don't want to be in this position. We don't want to be here today. We all have things better to do, but we have to protect our kids. So what can you do when it happens? Here's a checklist that we wrote for you. First, breathe. Deeply breathe, because you're going to be angry, you're going to be frustrated, and most of all, you're going to feel helpless. So I want to tell you, you're not alone. You're not alone. You're not helpless. We're here to support you. So know it. You can always call me, Mel, of course, Rachel. Rachel is my first speed dial for everything, really. And Bob, they're doing a great job. Then speak with your kid. Record everything, every single word, because every word matters. As you heard the panel, record how your kid is feeling. If they don't feel safe going the next day to school with that teacher, well, now you see, you know, it's a red flag. They just told you about that. Record everything. Then check if you can meet the teacher before you escalate. Our goal is not escalation. Our goal is to solve. Our goal is to help the kid go back to school feeling safe. If you can have a conversation with the teacher, great. Share with the teacher what happened from the point of view of the kid. Have a conversation. If you have a partner, that works. And there are a lot of teachers who are partners. Not every teacher has a bad intent or really want to make you unsafe. My kid came to school, same kid, by the way, now in Sunset. Saw a Magen David Time News cover on the wall. Was very curious. Took the article, opened it up. It says, Israel is not interested in peace. Article for 2010. Was very surprised. Sent me the article. Dad, what does this article say? I read through the article. What it actually said, that Israel does not have a partner for peace. So it gave up on peace. Well, the title does not say that, right? He took that article to the teacher, said, hey, this is the title, this is the content. Sorry, this does not reflect the content. Teacher said, you're right. This is an old article. I haven't read it for a while. Took it off. The next day, came to my son and said, hey, did you see that I took it off? I said, thank you. So you can do something. You can empower your kids to do something. If it doesn't work with the teacher, go and speak with the principal. Again, bring the community of the school. One more thing about the community. If you have a group of kids who are the community for that school, they know who they are, who each other are. They can support one another. Instead of being isolated, now they have someone to sit with at lunch. They can see one another. I got your back. That will help them go back to school and feel safe. And if nothing works, just two amazing humans here can help, and we're always here to help, and they have the tools to escalate where needed. Anything else to add, Mel?
You got it.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
So the recommendation, we have lists of everybody who's reached out to us from all the school districts, and I keep a list of every school, every where each parent is, and I can reach out to other parents if I know what school you're at to say, hey, I've met people from this school. Can you connect and be willing to talk? So that, yes. Yep. And I would recommend if you're on any of the Portland Jewish Moms or Portland Jewish Parent Facebook groups, those are also great resources to kind of feel out who's around.
And if you're willing to be a point person.
Yes, reach out to me.
Then you can also help to, you know, kind of bring people together as well, which is kind of what we're looking for.
Or if there, I was going to add, I know Maira Spivak is in the room. Several of our schools, especially high schools and some middle schools, have Jewish student unions. And so that's another opportunity to do that as well. And we're going to cover this coming up in a minute. So I know there was a question over here. Okay, I saw two hands. So I'm going to, two quick questions. And reach out to me, because I'm helping to facilitate these. And then one final question. Yeah. So we have a PPS WhatsApp group, and we are in discussions about potentially doing one for Beaverton School District. And if there are other districts, reach out to me. I already got an email tonight from somebody who wants to be in the PPS group. Shoot me an email. I will add you to the group. And we are, if you want to do the Ainsworth one through our WhatsApp group, let me know, and we can set up a sub-community. So.
Okay. So this last piece here will only be a few minutes. We're going to show you a typical day at the Jewish Federation, which I hate to say that it's a typical day, but unfortunately, it is a typical day.
Okay. Is my mic on? Okay.
So this is a phone call that one of us gets, and this is how it looks. Oh, yeah, I just have to answer the phone. Yeah. Hi, this is Bob Hornstein. Can I help you?
Hi, Bob. My name is Sarah. A friend of mine reached out and told me I should contact you. So my son David, he's an eighth grader. He's at Kinneman Middle School, And there's been another boy who's just been taunting him constantly and calling him a dirty Zionist. And he's telling the other boys that they shouldn't play with him because of this. They shouldn't play with that Zionist kid. So I reached out to his homeroom teacher, and she really didn't have any good answers. So she told me to reach out to the principal, so I did. And he said he would look into it. And he did get back to me a couple days later, because I asked him a couple of times, can I just read you his email?
Sure.
Back to me.
Okay, and just to be clear, this was just through email that you were communicating?
Correct.
Okay.
The homeroom teacher I had a conversation with, but everything else has been via email.
Okay.
So this is what he responded, and he wrote back, you know, 2 days after I emailed him a second time, and he said, I spoke to your son and to Matthew, who's the other kid, who said that David's been calling Matthew names. In other words, it appears that both boys are guilty of microaggressions and microbehavior. You know, he said it was typical behavior for that age. He said, I've alerted Matthew's parents around the situation, and they have assured me that they would talk to their son. And I'm sorry this happened, though I would dispute my characterization that Matthew targeted your son because of his Jewish faith. And then he says, I can contact him with any other concerns. But isn't he being targeted because of his faith? It just doesn't track for me, and I don't feel like I'm getting an adequate response from the school.
Has it continued?
Yeah, so now, you know, David came home really upset yesterday. Matthew is still saying this stuff, but it's doing it under his breath. But he's still hearing it, and he feels afraid to go into the lunchroom, and he's just not comfortable anymore.
Okay, so Sarah, first of all, thank you for calling, and I want you to know that you're not alone. You don't have to go through this alone, and we're here. So my colleague Rachel Nelson and I will work with you on this. But I want to ask you just a few questions. First of all, so the principal, if I understood, is telling you that your son is acting out toward the other boy. So you've obviously talked to your son, and I'm just curious, what does your son say?
Yeah, look, there is a certain level. They are middle schooler. They're eighth graders. There's a fair amount of teasing back and forth, 100%. My son is... I'd like to think he's a perfect angel. He is not a perfect angel, and I'm aware of that, and he and I have had very open, frank conversations. But he has also said that he's not targeting this other kid because of anything this kid has done, that he knows the line. He knows the difference.
So I'm really sorry. This is upsetting, and
yes,
it's unacceptable. And it's clear that the principal doesn't understand for many Jews that Zionism is an integral part,
yes,
of Jewish cultural and religious identity. So I think there's some education that needs to be done. So let me ask you, so you clearly didn't get a resolution from the principal. Now, every school district has a procedure, a policy process for filing a complaint. Are you familiar with that?
You know, no, I haven't, and nobody's mentioned that
to
me.
So you can go on the website, or if you prefer, we can actually go onto the website of XX School District, and we can send you the link.